KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forum's second hour this morning, author and Salon.com co-founder Scott Rosenberg will be joining us in studio for a wide-ranging discussion about blogging. We'll talk about the origins and the history of blogging and take on the thorny question of how good it is for society and the culture. The title of Scott Rosenberg's book may say it all. It's called Say Everything, How Blogging Began, What's Becoming, and Why It Matters, with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Well, as I said in the last hour, science fiction writer Bruce Sterling compares reading blogs to being beaten by croutons, and many dismiss blogging as trivial or narcissistic and bloggers as, well, too many with too much to say that amounts to too little. But blog chronicler and Salon.com co-founder and former managing editor of Salon.com, Scott Rosenberg, comes to the defense of blogs, and his analysis of the history and significance of blogging say everything. Rosenberg sees blogging as a hybrid of traditional publishing and electronic messaging that is a collective building of the web and follows its initial promise, encompassing the personal, the political, media, and business. He's also the author of Dreaming in Code and blogs at www.wordyard.com and joins us for this forum hour. Scott, good to see you.
Great to be here, Michael.
Let's begin with something newsy here before we talk about blogging or hear from our listeners on what they think about blogging. The FTC has come out with a statement. It's not necessarily at this point certain that it's going to go through, sort of like the Yahoo-Microsoft deal, but likely to go through, that says that, well, maybe they can't regulate the Internet, but they can come down on commercial practices that don't comply with federal trade laws, such as truth in advertising. So it's now considering revising its guidelines for editorials and testimonials in ads by requiring that bloggers tell readers when they've been paid or otherwise compensated by a company that they're writing about.
Yeah, the whole thing is kind of ironic because one of the original tenets of blogging is about transparency. You know, bloggers really do tell you everything about themselves, and that should give you the opportunity to judge how trustworthy they can be. And there's a very small group of bloggers that have sort of gotten into the business of recommending products, and some aggressive marketers have taken advantage of this to say, hey, we'll give you some freebies or we'll give you some money under the table if you'll promote our stuff. I think, you know, if the FTC does this, if their guidelines, well, they're going to be good guidelines, and we'll hope that it helps solve this problem.
But it brings up the question about how to trust the blogs, doesn't it? Or the blogger. I mean, how do we know in general? I'm not even talking about advertising, information. I mean, it's certainly a question I came away with after reading your book. How important is it really to trust who's giving you information over the blogging, over the blogosphere, and how do you determine who to trust?
Yeah, it's an important question that we all face today. I think that what you can tell when you're reading a blog is, first of all, who's writing it. That's a question you're going to ask any web page you land on. If the person doesn't tell you anything about himself or herself, you got a problem. And then you just start to dig in and say, well, what's the voice here? How much are they telling me about who they are and where they're coming from? A good blogger will tell you so much about where they're coming from that you're going to decide, oh, this person sounds reasonable and trustworthy or not. Also, they'll link. If they're saying something, they're going to provide backup. They're going to source provide sources through their links. And if they don't do that, that's another warning sign.
So you become the arbiter, in effect, and you decide on the basis of what they're being transparent with, but they may be, of course, not transparent at all in the sense of fictionalizing or distorting.
Sure. That's problem in...
Very common on the Internet in general.
It's a problem in old media, too. You know, it's a problem anywhere that someone is setting out to deceive you. What happens on the web, though, is there's a pretty fast self-corrective process. If somebody is doing that and achieving any kind of prominence with a fabrication, the debunking is going to happen pretty fast and furiously, and you'll probably hear about it.
You call the world of blogging the new public sphere, and you say, and this is fascinating to sort of my philosophically inclined, or what I like to think of as my philosophically inclined mind, you say it's ephemeral and yet it's timeless.
Yeah, the format of blogging, which evolved over the past really 15 years now, has this paradox at its heart. It does privilege the new, right? The newest stuff goes on the top of a blog page. But everything is archived. Everything has – each post has its own page that you can find in Google or your favorite search engine. And that gives each post a real permanence, or at least the closest thing to permanence that we have today on the web, something that lasts, something that the writer has taken and formed into this nugget of information that is going to be out there for people in the short term, and really, I think, in the long term, to mine. You know, this is the sort of the way we're writing our collective history today. This is what people are going to look at in the future when they say, "What was it like to live in 2009?"
This is our time capsule, in other words, or something along those lines. And you're certainly an enthusiast and a defender of the world of blogging. And you've heard all the arguments, I'm sure, about how there's so much trivia and narcissism and monologues replacing common discourse. I mean, those are the main arguments you hear. But you sort of frame this as an argument. It's kind of like phone calls. We should think of it in that metaphor.
There's different groups of blogging is now something that millions of people are doing. So you have this diversity of uses. You have people who are doing what really old traditional journalism using the blog form. You have a large number of people sort of at the bottom of the pyramid who are using a blog to just communicate with a small group of friends, colleagues, and that's the sort of more telephone-like aspect of it. And then in the middle, you have people who are displaying their expertise, who are saying, "I know about this subject and I'm excited about it. I'm passionate about it. I want to tell you about it." And that's another, you know, say everything. The book's title is sort of people hear that and they think, oh, this is where people are. You're talking about people who are telling us what they had for lunch. And that's certainly a part of it. But it's also say everything that you know. And people collectively, of course, know a huge amount about things that we want to know about. And that's where blogging, I think, answers this triviality charge. Yeah, there are people telling us what they had for lunch, but there are also people telling us everything they know about subjects that really matter. If you want to know today about the healthcare debate, if you want to know about during the election last year, if you wanted to understand the polls, well, a lot of us turned to this new blog that came along, 538.com. This guy who was an expert in baseball statistics turned his knowledge of that to polling and really gave us this crash course in the intricacies, what you could trust, what you couldn't trust in political polls. It was a great example of how blogging can actually go deep.
Well, you write early on in the book about 9/11. People want to know what happened to those they knew and those they loved and to understand what happened. And blogging really served that. Ironically, you also point out that Internet use dropped after 9/11, which is kind of fascinating. But now one would say with Twitter and with all of these kinds of new ways of communicating, the social networks and everything, blogging, as it served that early purpose, has been supplanted?
Oh, it hasn't been supplanted. It's, you know, every time a new media form comes along, it redefines the ones that preceded it. And so today what we're seeing is the people who were indeed blogging about minor things happening in their lives are probably doing it on Twitter or on Facebook, and they're not going to bother putting it in a blog post. And that's actually helped, I think, redefine blogging in a more substantial direction. Again, blogs are now where we put our longer thoughts.
Yeah, you don't have
the
word
ideas.
Limit like you do on Twitter, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
You're also talking here about sort of the pioneers behind blogging, and you get into this whole question of maybe it's not even that important a question. You know, how did blogging start or where did it start? You could take us back to the cave paintings, really, and talk about people like more contemporary, like I.F. Stone. I mean, you see that whole huge expanse of history. But to some extent, it's important, I guess, to see how it has evolved, because in understanding that past history, maybe we can project
exactly
where it's going.
What's important is that, when the web started, 15 years ago, when we first saw the web, we didn't really know what the form of expression on the web should take. And, you know, people like me, I came from print, started Salon.com. We thought we'd publish a web magazine at the time. And that was cool. It was a lot of fun. But it was imported from a previous medium. And It took people who were not whose minds weren't filled with these kind of previous forms. They were college students, software developers, renegade journalists, people who wanted to take advantage of, the web had this promise that it was going to be an open platform for anyone to contribute. But in the early days, it was really hard to do that. And the people who started the blogging movement took that promise seriously. And they said, well, how can we make this happen? How can we build the tools to make it easy for anyone to do this? And they had this vision that millions of people would one day be doing this. And at the time, that got mocked. You know, there were people who cynically said, well, that's crazy. We'll never see that. And indeed, we have.
Well, it's fascinating reading about some of these pioneers like Justin Hall, who really anticipated Twitter because he was doing stuff in real time. And when you look at these people, they're really visionaries. I mean, it goes back to people, like Tim Barron. What was his name again?
Tim Berners-Lee.
Tim Berners-Lee. I interviewed him. The name just dropped out of my head. Who really kind of invented the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
Mark Andreessen. And, I mean, these are the important figures, obviously, that we want to learn about if we want to understand how blogging evolved and where it's going and so forth. Where do you think it's going, by the way?
Well, you know, what I wanted to say before we look at the future is just to say that everywhere that it is going, these people, the pioneers of blogging who I write about in Say Everything, were there already. That's kind of the reason I wrote the book, was that I saw all of these encounters and difficulties people were having as they moved their lives onto the web and Facebook and Twitter and all the social networking enthusiasm we see today. All of these dilemmas about how much of my life do I reveal and how do I find people I trust? How do I cope with this onslaught of information? All of these problems, the early bloggers kind of had been there already. And I thought, there are lessons there that we need to capture for the future. And the future, I think, for blogging is not that different from the present. This is now a mature form. The form, it works. It's a wonderful, beautiful thing.
It's here to stay.
And it is here to stay.
Okay. Let's get back to some of the criticism, though. You read people like Andrew Keynes, creating an ignorant generation. It's leading to a counter-information age. How do you put those things to rest, or do we need to put those things to rest?
Well, I think the debate we're not going to put it to rest. I think the debate is a good one because anytime you have a new medium, you have opportunities and pitfalls. I don't see Keynes' book was Cult of the Amateur. He has this argument that we need professionalism, and I don't see professionalism vanishing. We have a sort of a business crisis in the media right now, where the business structures are being dismantled, and that is creating.
If you can't capitalize newspapers and you can't get traditional journalists like you used to be working in print, then blogs are going to be taking over. So the argument goes, and you have people who aren't answerable putting out blogs, not answerable like a news organization would be.
Well, they are answerable. They're just answerable in different ways. They're answerable to their readers. They're answerable to their public. Anytime you assemble a public, you're sort of answerable to it. To me, the newspaper isn't a kind of guarantee of credibility. It was a form that served its purpose and a business structure that served its purpose. Sadly, I see it, it's on its way out. And that, to me, looks like a done deal. The question is, how are we going to get the information we want in the future? And the web is a great platform for experiments. There's kind of green shoots everywhere already. And it's taking a little while. It will, but I'm optimistic.
Using the Ben Bernanke metaphor of green shoots, we're talking to Scott Rosenberg. His book is Say Everything, How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. And yet the argument persists that these are not professional journalists when you're talking about blogging opinions and editorials and repertorial kinds of stuff. And because they're not professional journalists, they're doing damage, or so the argument would go. They're putting stuff out there that can be urban legend, inauthentic, doesn't have to be fact-checked. It sort of all comes down to the consumer and how the consumer judges it, as you said before. But it can be a lot of stuff that's not, that they're not necessarily answerable for in the same way that, say, somebody who works for a certain newspaper can.
Well, the answer, you know, the professionalism is, for professional journalists, we've never had a credentialed press in this country, right? You don't, you know, it's based on who your employer is. And there's a professional kind of blogosphere that's emerged too. There are, you know, technology news outlets and business news outlets that are primarily blog-based now, and they have the same accountability, I would argue, in some ways even better accountability with their readership than a traditional news outlet does. So I don't see that accountability question being a big problem on the web. What you have in blogs is this form that is being simultaneously used by professionals and by a great mass of people who are not claiming to be journalists. They're just people communicating with one another. And if they spread misinformation, much of the time you will see that they'll correct it if somebody points it out, and people do. So there's this kind of constant feedback loop. I see, you know, the spread of misinformation on cable TV news being a lot more dangerous than the spread of misinformation on the web. That's where ideas like, you know, the birthers get their legitimacy.
Meaning that President Obama was not born in the United States, that argument. Yeah.
Which is not
true. Lou Dobbs day and night, I guess.
And yet here it is on cable all the time.
What about another argument that you hear, which is that there's a coarsening of the culture that comes through blogging, and particularly because of all the flaming and the snarkiness and the ranting, and it's much easier to do that. I never understood the whole phenomenon, but people who would never talk this way face-to-face online talk with a kind of, well, flaming attitude often, or a snarkiness that just is extraordinary.
Yeah, and it's a real phenomenon, and certainly you can find a lot of that on the web. It predates blogging. It's been around really since the days of, you know, email mailing lists where flaming first flourished. I think that people get the idea that that kind of tone is the natural tone for blogs, that that's what the medium creates. And in fact, that is what a certain subsection of the commercial blogosphere promotes. The primary example is Gawker, right? Gawker is a really kind of amazing, successful gossip and kind of New York media blog. Been around since the early days. It was one of the first blogs that was really trying to turn it into a business.
And I have a cousin who worked for it and actually left because of this whole snarkiness and
yes.
found it just too caustic.
And it's a part of the brand identity there, but it's not inherent in blogging. And for every gawker and for every snarky blogger, you could point to dozens of people who are really, civil and genuine. And there are whole communities of bloggers. There's a great community at Salon now, Open Salon, it's called, open.salon.com. Anyone can start a blog there. And you will find the most sort of civil, interested, supportive people imaginable there. It's the opposite of the sort of snark culture.
So blogging has, in your judgment, something for everyone.
I think so. When you have millions of people doing something, an activity that's open for anyone's participation, you're going to find that kind of diversity.
It's also changed the nature of our politics, nationally as well as locally.
You bet. It is the first example we have of at least the potential for a participatory campaign. We saw it originally with the Dean campaign in 2004 and in the past election cycle much more, a campaign that can actually listen to large numbers of people at its base. We're still, you know, we haven't sort of fulfilled the potential of that yet. There's miles to go, but at least there's an opportunity there.
What I think of sometimes with blogging, though, because there's so much in the blogosphere now, is that it's sort of like poets. There are lots of poets, but they're not necessarily reading other poets. They're writing poetry. There are a lot of people who are doing blogs, and they're not necessarily being read, and they're not necessarily reading other blogs.
Well, the best bloggers are. And really, once you start a blog and you start following, you start linking to other people and following the links that are coming to you, it's almost irresistible. You can't not read other blogs. As to, you know, how many blogs are being read, how many are being heard, you have a kind of vast competition for attention, right? Attention is really the scarcity in our culture now. And if you set out to start a blog and your goal is to get the attention of lots of people, it's much harder today than it was, you know, 5 or 10 years ago because there's so much more competition.
So which blogs do you find particularly compelling or engaging? Anything you'd recommend that people A lot of read?
Oh, I'm a big fan of Talking Points Memo. I have a chapter in Say Everything that tells its story. It's Josh Marshall's blog. It's a political blog, but it's also this sort of test bed for investigative reporting on the web. It's a great counterexample to the people who complain that, you know, bloggers just sit around in their pajamas and never pick up the phone and never do any reporting. There's a lot of reporting on blogs, so that's one of my favorites.
Or the fact that there has been so many cutbacks with respect to investigative reporting on newspapers.
Sure.
Talking Points doing good work.
Yeah, definitely.
Who else?
I would take a look at, some of my colleagues at Salon.com are now doing blogs. That's the part of the, you know, every good journalistic organization now has people blogging. So if you're interested in understanding the economic crisis of the last year and a half, there are lots of economists blogging, and I could point you to a lot of them. But you kind of, if you want to sort of dip your toe in first, you don't want to dive right into the complexities of the professional economists' debates, I'd point you to Andrew Leonard's blog, How the World Works, which is a great one.
What about this blog that you're doing?
I've been blogging since 2002, and it's a classic personal blog. It's not sort of the centerpiece of my life. I'm not trying to turn it into a business. It's where I kind of keep people up to date with what I'm doing. I'm writing a lot about Say Everything on it. When I start a new book project, I'll probably start writing about that. I have, you know, a few hundred to a few thousand readers, and it's great. That's where, you know, that's sort of my little community.
Why not turn it into a business? And what would you tell people who want to turn a blog into a business?
To turn a blog into a business, you have to do two things. You have to build a large audience, and then you have to monetize it. And I'd spent many years at Salon sort of attempting to grapple with those problems. And for me, that's just not where I'm, you know, passionate right now of trying to solve that problem. Monetizing anything on the web is not easy.
As every newspaper will tell you.
Yeah. And so really, one of the points that I really wanted to make in Say Everything was that we tend to look too much at blogs as a business and too little as a cultural outlet for individual self-expression. And I wanted to redress that balance a little bit.
Where do you think the balance is lying right now? I mean, some would say perhaps not so much on the cultural side.
Well, I think they're missing the picture. I think they're not actually looking at what's happening out there. The number of people who are writing about things that they love, subjects that they care about, whether it's, you know,
like what they had for lunch?
Not what they had for lunch, but the things that they're really expert in, whether it's, you know, how to knit something to how to reform healthcare. These are what people are writing about.
Well, let's find out what our listeners have to say about this. We're talking about blogging in the blogosphere, and you may have some thoughts about, well, not only what blogs out there are worth spending your time with, but just the whole notion of the impact and the effect of blogs and of blogging on our culture and on our politics. Might want to even speculate about where you think it's going and how much it plays a role in your life, whether you like it and why you do it, or whether you stay away from it and find it doesn't quite satisfy you or you have some aversion to it. Let me open the phone lines and invite you to join us. It's toll-free wherever you're listening or however, on radio, internet, or a Sirius XM satellite. We welcome your calls. You can join us now at 866-733-6786. Again, that phone number, 866-733-6786, or simply send an email, forum@kqed.org, and for some strong opinions about blogging, especially for some people who spend their time in the blogosphere. Our guest is Scott Rosenberg. His book is Say Everything, How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. And again, we welcome your questions and comments. Anything about the world of blogging that's on your mind, feel free to join the program, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. And when we return, we'll find out about blogging from your perspective. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Scott Rosenberg, former managing editor and co-founder of Salon.com, who is also the author of Dreaming in Code and His new book, Say Everything, How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters, and that is indeed the subject of this hour. Blogs that you like, blogs that you don't like, what you like about the blogosphere and don't like about it, and where you think it's all headed, and what kind of impact it's having. And in fact, we'll go to your calls here in just a moment. I was just saying off mic, though, to Scott that I recently, an editor I knew, offered to create a blog for me, and I was just thinking about the time, you know. You don't know in going into it what kind of an audience you're going to get to begin with, but the time investment, I know they're not all sitting in their pajamas, but, you know, for people who have a pretty busy life or an overly busy life, like I'm afraid I do, you know, doing a blog is really quite a challenge.
If you're committed to doing it on a regular basis, you bet it takes time and energy. What often happens is people start very casually. They just figure, you know, I'll post, you know, every now and then, once a week, once a month, when the fancy hits me, and then they get drawn in. They actually find people start commenting. They start thinking as they're doing something else, gee, I should post about that. And they, even though they didn't intend to commit a lot of time, they just find that happening sort of organically or naturally because it's something that is seductive in that way.
Well, that's what people do on Postbook too, though. I mean, they sure. Post on Facebook, excuse me, in the same way.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
As the spirit moves.
And Facebook is certainly, you know, where a certain amount of energy that people might have been putting into blogging is going today. Blogging today is more for people who are really interested in cultivating their own voice.
Let's hear from some of our listeners' voices. And Susie, we'll begin with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So I, you know, got into blogging as a creative aspect. I thought I would get into it to make a little money, and it turned so much more into that. And I started actually, my cats started blogging. So I don't actually blog, I'm just their staff. But my cats blog in their voice and have their own language. And I was just amazed at this quote unquote cat blogosphere that started popping up. And I probably, well, I get 10 times more comments on my cat's blog, or they get more comments than I do in my other blogs that are about me and what I do. And I found this whole network of individuals that are cats and have other pets, but they are able to use their cat voice to really express what's going on for them, what's going on in their lives, being able to connect with other people that maybe some of these individuals wouldn't otherwise be comfortable talking or meeting someone personally. Maybe people who are shut in, who don't get out, who are unemployed, who are socially withdrawn, but their cats are creating social networks.
This sounds like one of those B movies, the cat people are.
But we're a bunch of crazy cat people. But, you know, even through that, I was able to post things that, you know, my cats would say, my, you know, human parents are looking for this opportunity, or they're. When my husband and I were wanting to adopt, I mean, my cat said to this cat community, hey, help our family grow. And these cat people, these cat bloggers, made those connections happen. These individuals, there is such a strength in this group. And I'm sure it happens with artists. Or, you know, my 19-month-old daughter has her own blog, and she talks in her voice.
Well, you've got feline blogs, you've got knitting blogs, you've got all kinds of varieties, as we've been saying here. And the question is, it reminds me of Howard Rheingold's whole idea of virtual communities, you know, which he came, mm-hmm. when he first came out with that book years ago, we had him on for him. And it certainly happened, but it's also kind of a splintered special interest way of looking at things. And it's a narrow prism sometimes, and it also involves special interest, but never again this contact. So much of it is, unless you meet off the blogosphere or away from the blogosphere, it's all kind of encompassed and embodied in that, isn't it?
Well, but it's a human connection that people find, I think. You
virtual
know
connection.
But it's real. I mean, it's people talking to each other. So
it's cats talking to each
well,
other.
Well, and so they're finding a playful literary way of having fun and yet telling real stories, I think, as the caller said.
Well, we thank the caller, and we'll move along and hear from some more people who have some thoughts about the blogosphere. Polly, hi, you're on.
Hi. I had a comment and then a question, and actually, fortunately, my comment flows pretty straight from what you were just talking about. I've been writing – well, first off, I consider myself a writer who went and began to use the blog as a means to self-publish as I continue to do kind of rough drafts, I would say. I consider writing a blog a way to do to basically have an open studio, as it were, and invite the people whom I'm trying to write to into a dialogue with me as a writer. My blog is Lesbian Dad, and I have been exploring parenthood and gay parenthood and our place in contemporary society. And I just my comment about
how many readers do you think you have? Do you know?
Well, I know, and it's about it varies between 7,000 and 15,000 a month unique readers, and they visit about 1,000 to 2,000 visit a day.
Now, how do they find you?
Well, actually, sort of at one level, it's a fairly organic process. I began to write, and people began to read me, and I began to communicate in a community or participate in a community, as Scott Rosenberg is saying. I mean, people. Good bloggers read other people and start to comment, and my presence as a reader commenting on other people's work began to draw them to my work. But I also won a sort of a populist award when my first year that my blog came out, the Weblog Awards Best New Blog, and that drew positive and negative attention since some right-wing political group-authored blogs were also competing for that award, and that drew a lot of attention. So it's both an organic process insofar as you can just sit still and continue to write, and people will search for reasonable, interesting writing on a topic, and they'll find you.
Well, Polly, good of you to call here. Who decides Scott Rosenberg awards for blogs? I mean, it's like the Oscars here with blogs.
Well, there are many, and I don't remember which one exactly. But you know, I've actually read Polly's Lesbian Dad blog, and it's a great one, and it's just an example of how I don't remember why I followed a link from somebody else's blog, read a great post, and I still remember it. So that's that's powerful.
Let me bring more callers on. We go to Castro Valley and welcome Kate. Hi, you're on the air. Kate, are you there? Let me try one more time. Kate from Castro Valley?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I got into blogs when I was pregnant with my first child, looking for a community of people that were going through the same thing as I was. And now I'm considering starting my own.
That's great. There's a huge community of parents, of moms who are connecting with each other and learning from each other and getting an outlet, having some communication with other adults who are dealing with the same things they're dealing with.
And providing useful information in many cases,
you
of
bet.
Course. I mean, that's really the point, I think, that needs to be hammered home here. And thank you, Kate, for that call. Let me bring Janelle on from Oakland. Hi, Janelle.
Hi. I wanted to share my favorite blog and explain why I like it so much.
Yes.
It's crooksandliars.com. It's a political blog, and it's put together by this guy named John Amato. And on the caption underneath Crooks and Liars, of the title, it says, an online magazine. Okay, it's really a blog, as though there's something to be apologetic for because it is a blog. But the reason I like it is because wherever bloggers he coordinates there, he actually – they all use very primary sources, videos, quotes, documents, and I can see what, basically politicians or activists are saying or pundits are saying at the time. It's literally coming out of their mouth. So I find it to be a little more dependable than many other blogs. And with this blog, you have an option. You can click on comments or not. And I like not having to, have to navigate through a bunch of comments, which at times can be sort of ratty and whatever.
One of the things that Crooks and Liars did, it's a great liberal blog. Before YouTube, it was one of the first blogs that actually started grabbing video clips of news and political events as they were happening and TV coverage and so forth and putting them out there for the readers to look at themselves. And that was, YouTube has kind of made that ubiquitous now, but this was before it. That was really how Crooks and Liars got started.
Are there blogs posing as online magazines? is that something that's out there?
Yeah, I think it's pretty uncommon at this point, I think. But whatever they, the labels are cheap.
Thank you, Janelle, for your call. What do you think? Are there more blogs on the left or the right? I mean, particularly on those ends.
At this point, there are more on the left. It's interesting because in 2001 and 2, the right sort of dominated. After 9/11, it was the same time that blogging really first took hold. There was this movement called the War Bloggers. And if you go back and read their stuff, they were convinced that blogging was a natively, inherently conservative form because it privileged the individual voice, and that matched the sort of libertarian ideal. And of course, within a year or two, as the debate about the Iraq war exploded and so forth, the left kind of came back and has been very strong in the blogosphere ever since. And today you hear arguments that the blogging is inherently a liberal or left-oriented thing. And I think it's just a reflective of the mood of the country.
Amy joins us from Berkeley. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I just wanted to know, what do blog sites do to curb or manage flaming that sometimes can be really aggressive and almost take the form of cyberbullying, which I think prevents useful discussion? And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
The comments in the early days, there some bloggers had this notion that they shouldn't police or manage the comments, that was somehow infringing on people's freedom of speech. As the blogospheres have exploded, no one takes that point of view anymore. Everyone understands that the blog is like your front porch. You have the right to manage or, you know, delete comments if you think they're inappropriate. So the best bloggers really do a certain amount of management of the comment threads and really keep them civil. And if you see that that's not happening, then, you know, maybe you should find a different blog to read.
Well, here again, you have to look back at the history of some of these figures, these seminal figures in the history of blogging that you highlight and that you talk about, write about, in your book. Jorn Barger, I guess, is a good example. Anti-Semitic rants and all of that. Brilliant guy. I mean, wrote about James Joyce, and it's a really smart fellow. Turned into, I guess, a homeless waif,
not quite, but
almost,
but yeah. On the edge.
But there was a lot of ranting from him.
Yeah, although he never had comments on his blog, and he used to get into sort of email flame fests. These questions of civility have been on the internet from the very beginning. Blogs are a great form because each blogger can decide just how much flamage he or she wants to allow. And the best blogs, I think, do a good job of curbing that.
A couple of emails. One from Randy writes, I limit this criticism to blogs on public affairs, government activities, i.e. news. Journalism, like any craft, is based on skills that have been traditionally taught in journalism schools. Without those skills, the act of reporting becomes devolved to opinions. As professional news organizations disappear, there will be no more sources for the links that the opinion bloggers have at least peppered their blogs with. Then what?
Well, this is this argument we hear all the time, and my response is, first of all, traditional journalists are, you know, many of them went to journalism school. Many of them were sort of trained on the job. The structure of their business is going away. So the question for us is, how do we build the institutions that will train the skills that we need from the people who are going to be bringing us our information tomorrow? And that's beginning already. So I'm really not worried about that.
Kevin in San Rafael writes, we speak of the need to grow and allow blogging to continue to be wide open. The potential of talent found out there is grand, yet as human nature dictates, we are attracted to fear and smear. The lowest common denominator is what the mass public sees and interprets, and unfortunately, that is the present of blogging. How do you suggest those out there that are holding to a code of ethics press the issue decorum in blogging?
Well, so the mass taste, anytime you get a mass of opinion together, you're going to it's going to be governed by the mass. Blogging, the value in blogging is that no one is requiring you to follow that. It's not like broadcast TV where there's a limited number of channels, and so the mass sort of—
There are lots of channels, and you can switch them too, yeah.
But there's still, it's still, you can't just— start one yourself tomorrow for free, the way you can with a blog.
Oh, no, actually, there are these cable outlets where people can go. I mean, nobody hardly watches them, unfortunately, but, in different communities where they can do their own television show or at least—
The bandwidth is still limited, and blogging and the web in general lets you follow your own taste in a much more— in-depth way.
Scott Rosenberg's book is Say Everything. By the way, he'll be appearing at Book Passage. When are you going to be there?
Monday.
This Monday evening at 7 o'clock, and we'll take more of your calls. Kristen from El Cerrito, morning.
Good morning. I'm an Episcopal priest, and there are several blogs and blog rings that I actually follow consistently because they've become forums for people to do text studies of the Bible scripture studies that are coming up every week, and specifically, it's become this online community and a way to help prepare for sermons and exchange ideas, and that has become an essential tool for me as I prepare for sermons every week.
That's great. That's just one example, and I'm sure that there are, in each denomination, you're going to find that. What I wonder is there any cross linking? Do the people in your community also sort of look at how other groups of bloggers that may have different views on those texts view them? That's that's where it starts to get really interesting to me.
There is this thing called the Revised Common Lectionary, so a lot of the mainline Christian denominations, like across different churches, all use the same text, so there's definitely different voices that way. I do sometimes look at more conservative blogs, but generally that's not the community I'm preaching to, so it's not really of interest to me or my parish.
You're giving kind of a trade secret out here, aren't you, Kristen? Where you get your sermons from?
I don't get my sermons there, but definitely having, that group of people to exchange ideas with, or someone will have an insight that can definitely prompt my own thinking, and it's really valuable.
Yeah, understood. Thank you for that call, and let's hear next from Joy. Hi, Joy.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to point out that I found blogging very useful in the context of a community of whistleblowers and potential whistleblowers, in the sense that it provides a place where people can discuss anonymously what can't be perhaps discussed in the workplace or in some political systems, for example. So I think it's a very useful tool for trying to ferret out information in environments that aren't necessarily open.
Yeah, this whole question of whistleblowing is fascinating. People usually complain about anonymity on blogs and say, well, anonymity is a curse because if you don't know where the information is coming from, how can you trust it? And that's, often
so legitimate criticism.
But the possibility, the opportunity to be anonymous also gets certain kinds of messages out that you wouldn't be able to get any other way. And that's a starting point. When you get that kind of information, it doesn't mean you automatically trust it. That's a starting point for a deeper investigation. And we find this not only in terms of whistleblowers about corruption in government and business, but also just for people's experiences. One of the blogs I write about in Say Everything is called Waiter Rant. It was an anonymous waiter's blog. He just wanted to write about his experience. You weren't going to hear these kinds of stories from someone who told you where he worked. But you got a vivid and kind of funny picture of what it was like to be a waiter.
But talk some more about that anonymity, because like I said, and as you indicated, it is something that's come under some real criticism, the idea that with anonymity comes the absence of responsibility.
And that's absolutely true. What I always sort of point out is that sadly, we have a huge amount of anonymous information in mainstream media. We have anonymous sources being used as the basis for much of our political coverage.
Just reading about all these unnamed sources in the Yahoo Microsoft deal. In fact,
So anonymity is always a red flag. It's not to me a dead stop. It's a caution sign.
Let me go to some of your emails. Ronnie from Novato writes, okay, suppose someone's interested in pursuing this. Do you have any suggestions how to find the blogs you're likely to be interested in?
The best thing to do is to start with at least one that you have found in a field that you're passionate about, whether it's politics or some personal interest, and start there and follow the links. See who that blogger who you like is pointing you to, and kind of spread out from there. I find that much more effective than trying to find blogs in a search engine. Search engines are great for finding individual posts, but they're not necessarily the best way to find a voice that you want to follow over time.
Here's Art, who says, important voices are present in the blogosphere. I recommend Some Assembly Required, Ilargi on the Automatic Earth, and Howard Kunstler in Cluster Bleep Nation. They cut to the bone consistently and are an important antidote to all the gas that's being generated in the general media. You do hear about some blogs that really are given those kind of laudatory remarks as being much better than general media. Amanda says, seems to me that most blogs, social networking sites, are breeding grounds for narcissism. It hinders our communication with others, making our discourses trivial at best.
Well, this narcissism question is, you know, you can find lots of narcissism on the web because our culture has a lot of narcissism in it. But if you are truly narcissistic about your blog, you're going to find yourself talking to yourself. The best bloggers are always involved in a conversation with others. And to me, that's the opposite of narcissism.
Well, I read Christopher Lash many years ago. I don't know if you did, Culture of Narcissism. And he makes the point that, indeed, we've become, in many respects, through many ways of looking at it, a culture of narcissism. But there is the argument that social networks and blogging exacerbate that to a greater degree. And I'm not so sure that it's wrong.
Well, I think that if you have this tendency to be narcissistic and you're constantly putting it out in public, you're more likely to hear back from other people that, you know, maybe you should be spreading out your attention a little more widely.
Well, we'll do that with more of our callers, and let's get you on, Ken. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I'm sort of a somewhat advanced computer user. I've built my own computer. I do a little coding, but mostly I read news or say something specific about a product I might want to buy. I want to know if there are, you know, pros, cons, problems like that. But I really, it seems to me that there's more mention of blogging than there is actually reading of it, in the same way that Twitter gets mentioned all the time. And most people I know sign up for these Twitter accounts and really don't use them. So I think the user statistics are very skewed. How do you recommend people use blogging, which is kind of like a substitute word for writing? It's so broad. I'm wondering, what the heck are you guys talking about? Please be specific. If I was working for XYZ Corporation, I'd be very interested to see what my coworkers might be writing about what's really going on. I mean, it's very specific to me. But in general, what do people look for in searching for blogs?
Well, in general, people look for the specifics. So, you know, it depends on your specifics. I would, first of all, in terms of the numbers, the latest Pew Internet study showed that something like 10% of the American adult population said that they read blogs on a regular basis. Now, you know, that's one number. Their studies are pretty solid. So,
it's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. But it's splintered, right? It's the people reading the stuff at XYZ Corporation, or the people following the hobby that they love, or the people talking with other moms about their experiences raising a family. For me to be specific to you, I would have to know much more about you and your life. I can't point you specifically to the three blogs that you personally need to read. But if you're, if you're in the computing field, ask a friend.
Well, the caller's question also brings up how we define a blog. I mentioned Jordan Barger before, who gave us weblog. And then I guess it was Peter Merholtz who gave us the word blog. And what did he mean by blog?
At the time, in 1999, we were talking about sites that published items in reverse chronological order, usually with lots of links. And that's really the definition that's kind of stayed with us, although the form has expanded and grown and encompassed, you know, a much wider variety of expression, and everything from essays to poetry to you name it.
Ken, it's out there for you to discover, and we thank you for the call. We'll get more of your calls on here. We'll get John on next. John, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yeah, hi. I had a point to make about something that was discussed earlier about the validity of what bloggers write, and I generally agree with what the guest is saying about the pros and cons of blogs, but I wanted to, an anecdotal story of mine is that I was a PR senior manager for a major tech corporation in Silicon Valley for 10 years, And we loved the bloggers because we knew that we could always send them free product, and we never got anything but great reviews on those products. Bloggers, unlike journalists, never sent the products back, and we understood that they wouldn't. And so I think my point is that I think it's really important that readers on the web are better educated and trained about being super cautious about believing what they read. And in the past, with the media landscape as it used to be, perhaps we didn't have to worry about that so much.
I think John makes a good point. I think, you know, bloggers are susceptible to being shills.
Absolutely. I agree. And I think that, you know, to the extent that you see a blog where all of the reviews and product recommendations are positive, that should be a red flag. That should be something where you say, wait a minute, you know, where are the negative reviews?
Let me thank John for the call, and we're going to hear from next. Polly, morning. You're on.
Oh, hi. Yeah, hi. Thanks. And first off, I appreciate the opportunity to get the question in. I wanted to ask Scott Rosenberg about his reflections regarding gender in the blogosphere. Insofar as blogs are self-published, they sidestep traditional gatekeeping in the media, and I know that a great deal of women are writing and reading online. I think the Blogger Network, Blogher, has done a lot of studies of this and have found, I think, that women are disproportionately writing and reading. And I just wanted to...
Most of our callers today have been women callers.
Yeah, in the early days of blogging, it was considered a male-dominated form because it was started in the tech world, and that has a sort of built-in gender bias. Today, it really reflects the population, and I think because a blog is a space where you really you get to express yourself. No one can sort of tell you to shut up. A lot of women have found it a great way to just get their voices heard in a different way, in a space where they can speak without feeling intimidated the way they might in some other forums.
A blog of her own, to
indeed
draw from Virginia Woolf. Thank you, Scott, for being with us. And the book, again, is Say Everything by Scott Rosenberg, How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. He'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera Monday at 7. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. One of extend thanks to our whole staff, our senior editor Dan Zoll, and our producers Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg, and our interns Isabel James, Marcus Farage, Kylie Gordon, and Paul Boyer. Forum's engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And thank you. We would not be here without you and appreciate your listenership. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.